You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
Oh, I'm trying, I'm trying, I'm trying, I'm trying, I'm trying, oh, trying, I'm trying, I'm trying, I'm trying, I'm trying, not to think about you. No, 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 not to think about you.
Welcome to Nobody Told Me. I'm Jan Black.
And I'm Laura Owens. And joining us today is Dr. Jack Schaefer. He is a retired FBI special agent who specialized in behavior analysis and trying to get people to confess to their crimes. In his book, The Like Switch, he shares his proven strategies on how to instantly read people and influence how they perceive you so that you can turn strangers into friends in any aspect of your life, whether that be in a job interview or on a first date. Welcome to the show, Dr. Schaefer. So how did the idea first come about for the like switch?
Well, it's kind of interesting. I used to teach intelligence officers how to go overseas and introduce themselves to strangers and be friends with strangers in order for them to get classified information from people overseas. So one of my classes, I was got there early. There was two students sitting there, very eagerly waiting for the class to start, which is very unusual.
Right.
We've been there. And I asked them, you know, I went down there to, you know, get ready for class. And I said, what are you guys doing here? And they said, we can't wait for class to start. And I said, well, that's odd. Why? And they asked me, you know, they asked me if I remembered a previous student. I said, yeah. And they said, well, we went to the bar one day with them. And he told me that he could get a girl to come over to our table without saying a word.
Wow.
Of course, they didn't believe it. And the student took the challenge, and the two students who challenged him picked the person in the bar that they wanted to come over to meet them and have a drink. So using the nonverbal behaviors that we teach in class, he was able to nonverbally send a signal to this particular target. And about 30, 40 minutes later, her friend left. She walked over, drink in hand, and said, do you mind if I sit down and have a drink with you? And they looked at me with very excited voices and said, that's what we want to learn. I said, I'm not here to teach you how to be a pickup artist. I'm here to teach you how to be an intelligence officer.
Yeah. Yeah. But hey, if picking somebody up is a side effect, why not?
Well, that's what they said. They said, you should write a book on this because it works in the dating world.
Tell us how you became an expert in it.
Well, you know, I was always interested. I remember being a child and sitting in the mall, you know, 8, 9 years old. I'd go to the mall with my mom and dad, and I'd sit and just watch people. So I think I've always had some kind of interest in watching people. And since I became an agent, the whole goal of being in law enforcement is you either have to get someone to confess to a crime that will put them in jail for the rest of their life, and they know that you're there to put them in jail for the rest of their life. So how do you get that person to become friends with you enough and trust you enough where they say, yeah, I did this evil crime, and I know I'll be going away for a long time, but I want to tell you what I did. And it translates also for intelligence. If we capture a spy or we want to recruit somebody, what we have to do is be friends with that person and then somehow convince them that they should work for our side instead of their side. So there's a lot of psychological techniques that go into convincing somebody of, you know, to actually do things that are against their best interest.
So if you're just going in to talk with somebody when you were an FBI agent, how did persuasion play a role?
Well, what you want to do is nobody's going to confess to you unless they like you. So we would set up not verbal and nonverbal strategies to convince that person to be our friend and then to confide in us. And it starts from the beginning. And this goes for all relationships, basically. There's friend signals and foe signals that we send out. Our brain is constantly looking into the environment for threats. And so when we meet each other, we exchange friend and foe signals. And there's three major friend signals, and the first one is a long-distance signal, which is the eyebrow flash. It lasts about 1/64th of a second.
Wow.
When we approach one another, one person will send an eyebrow flash out, and the other person will reciprocate with an eyebrow flash. So we've just nonverbally told each other we're not a threat. And our brain sees that as a friend signal and kind of ignores that person, and it continues to use more energy to look for a threat.
And you talk about how you can observe a person's mouth while you're talking to them to get a good idea of what they're thinking. So what should we look for?
Well, you know, if you want to, first thing you look for is a smile. That's the second friend signal, is the smile. And what the smile does, it releases endorphins. So if I smile at you, I'm going to receive endorphins. And if you smile back at me, you're going to receive endorphins. So that's one way we can use, you know, look at the mouth and determine or help influence or predispose people to like us. There's other things you can do with the mouth, too, and that's called the lip purse. When you purse your lips, that tells me that you formed a sentence in your mind that is in opposition to what I just said. I'm a professor at Western Illinois University, and when I'm giving a lecture, I look at my students' mouths, and when I see one of the students purse their lips, I say, so you disagree with what I just said. And they have this astonished look, and they go, how did you know that? I say, well, because I'm in the FBI. I know these things.
Wow. But
it's not as easy as that. The real reason, it's not a mystery. The real reason is I saw that lip purse.
Now, what's the third sign of friendship?
Oh, the third one is the head tilt. When you tilt your head to one side or the other, that signifies that you're not a threat, because when you tilt your head, you expose your carotid artery, which is vital for your life, because it sends the blood up to your brain. So when you tilt your head, you're exposing it to that other person. And that sends a signal that I'm not afraid that you're going to hurt me or cut my carotid artery. So that's a friend signal. You see this with dog owners, often see this when they go home to see their dogs. And as soon as you open the door, the dog will sit there and tilt its head to one side or the other. So the dog is sending the owner a signal that says, I'm not a threat. The other thing a dog will do is flip over on its back and expose its stomach, you know, for the little belly rub. And what the dog is saying is, I'm exposing my underbelly, which is needs to be protected or it could hurt me. And he's saying, hey, I trust you enough. I'm going to allow you to, you know, touch my underbelly.
Well, what is the worst thing that you can do when meeting somebody?
Well, we call that the urban scowl. Is if you don't send off these friend signals, in other words, if you knit your eyebrows and you furrow up your face and you scrunch your eyes and you expose your teeth, and people see that, I call that the urban scowl. Because when you're walking in a big city, there's a lot of predators. And what you have to do is let those predators know nonverbally that you're going to be a very difficult target. And they better, you know, go find another target, because it's going to be difficult to make prey of you. And I grew up in the south side of Chicago, and I made a habit. I mean, you almost had to. I walked around with an urban scowl all day, and I said, that's, you know, back away. Don't mess with me. Mm-hmm. And it hurt me, though, because when I met my future wife out in the suburbs, I used to go out there and be with her, and her friends said that I was mean and I looked mean, and they were afraid to talk to me because they said it looked like he was going to bite my head off.
Wow.
And she said that to me, and I went, oh, it dawned on me. I'm wearing this urban scowl that says, don't mess with me, in an environment where everybody's friendly and there's fewer predators.
Well, that brings to mind a question then. Do you think that there is, if we're sending these subtle signals to one another when we first meet each other about whether we're friendly or approachable or what, do you think there is such a thing as love at first sight because of those signals?
Well, it depends on how you define love. You know, I mean, if it's the initial, interest, And if you want to call that love, yes, I believe that people can feel instantly attracted to one another. Some people call that love. Other people don't. You know, love is a deeper bond that people have between one another that takes time to form. So if that's the definition, I don't believe in love at first sight. But if it's that instant attraction you feel towards somebody by the way they look, by the way they act or talk, if that's the definition of love, then yes, I believe that's there.
So there could definitely be like at first sight then.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So once you've gotten past initial greetings and initial nonverbal cues that you were talking about, you want to know that you're on the right track with the person. So how do you know if you've established rapport, whether that be in a friendship or a romantic relationship or in a workplace setting?
Well, there's several things to do that. One of the things you can do is offer somebody, typically, but what I would do is go out and have something to eat or something to drink with that person for a number of reasons. First, when 70% of all information is exchanged over food or drink. So when we sit down and have a drink or food, we are predisposed to talk to people. So people are more likely to talk to one another when they're eating or drinking. The second thing you can do is watch where the person places the cup or the glass that they're drinking from. If they place the cup or glass right in front of you, between you and the person you're talking to, then that forms a barrier. That barrier says rapport has not been developed. And as the conversation goes on and you build more and more rapport, that person will take that cup and put it to the side and remove that barrier. So that's one way you can test for relationship or rapport. The second way you can do it is mirroring. When people are in rapport with one another, they tend to mirror one another's behaviors and posture. So when you initially meet someone, you want to mirror their behavior to let that person know that you're in rapport with them. But if you want to test for it, you don't know if they're mirroring you because you're mirroring them. So what you want to do is change positions. So if you have your legs crossed, uncross your legs and lean back in your chair. If you have rapport with the other person is going to follow that new display and assume it within 10 to 15 seconds.
That's fascinating.
Wow. that technique is called lead and follow. You know, just change your position. And you see that a lot of times in offices where everybody's standing around and they're just chit-chatting. Everybody has their arms crossed. And then one person will uncross the arms and take the weight off one foot and put it on the other. And guess what? Within seconds, everybody's doing that if they're in rapport.
And nobody's even aware of the fact that they're doing
Nobody's even aware of it. And, you know, you can use this in a business setting. Because if you're at a conference and you're making a presentation, you look for the people that are mirroring you. If they're mirroring you, you know that you have rapport with them and they're liking what you're saying. And what I would tend to do then, if I see everybody mirrored me, I wouldn't concentrate on those people. I'd look for the people that aren't mirroring me, because those are the people that need convincing to either, you know, buy something or a service or product. So I would focus on those people because those are the ones that need, convincing. So you can tell who's on your side and who isn't.
So much of our communication these days is done not in a one-on-one situation because of texting and other forms of social media. How is that changing your ability to read people or our ability in general to read people?
Well, it affects it a great deal because we spend so much time on our media, social media, and we're so focused on texting and emailing and those types of things that we don't take the time to interact with one another. So we get out of practice. And that's why, particularly I see the millennials at Western, where I teach, that they don't communicate well with one another unless you give them a phone. And I do an experiment. I take two of the students on the first day of college or first day of class when they don't know each other, put them up in front of the room, put them in two chairs facing each other, and I say, now talk for 5 minutes. They have a difficult time. they ask me, what do you want me to talk about? You know, what do I do? What do I say? I don't know what to say. I don't know that person. Then I said, all right, go back to back and start texting one another. No problem. So that shows you they're very comfortable communicating via electronic media, and they're not very comfortable face to face. So they've lost some of the techniques that, you know, older people rely on to make friends.
So if you're not in a face-to-face setting and you don't have the benefit of being able to see the person to kind of read their facial signals, facial expressions, how can you tell if you're building a rapport with them online?
Well, you know, that's dangerous because we rely mostly on verbal cues to tell us if that person, if we expose too much of ourselves, the other person frowns or looks away or looks disinterested, and that tells us, whoa, we better stop being too intimate too quick with this person. On the internet, however, you don't rely on those verbal cues. I mean, the nonverbal cues, you rely on verbal cues or written cues, and we're taking ourselves out of the area where we're very good at judging people, and we're putting ourselves in an environment where we're not very good at judging people. So it's very difficult to communicate solely on the internet. And it's very dangerous because, you know, people have a tendency to say too much on the internet.
You say that persuasion is a powerful tool and that with persuasion, there are really no winners or losers. Explain more about that and how we can become masters of the art of persuasion.
Here's what people typically do is they're going to negotiate with people. I'm going to negotiate you, and we're going to get a deal, and everything's going to be good. Well, in all negotiations, there's a winner and a loser. And if you happen to come up on top of the negotiations, the other person's going to feel like a loser. So that's an adversarial situation. When you want to persuade people, there's no winners or losers. All you're doing is trying to convince somebody that your position is the one they should follow or believe in. So what you want to do is persuade rather than to negotiate.
And how do you do that?
Well, you can, the first thing you want to do is you want to establish rapport with that person. So you use the friend signals. And then one of the more powerful tools that you can use to build rapport is the empathic statement. And the empathic statement is nothing more than you take what that person feels, their physical status, or what they say. Using parallel language, you mirror that back to them. So I use that often in college because I get on the elevator and I see a student that's smiling and looks very happy. I'll say, you look very happy today. So all I'm doing is taking what I see and mirroring it back to them. And they'll typically say, yeah, I just passed a very difficult test. So that empathic statement I form then is, so you worked really hard and studied hard and it paid off. And that's exactly what they're saying. So I just mirror it back to them. And then they add another one like, yeah, it was a difficult test. And you can carry on that conversation for a long time using empathic statements. And once you get to be friends with people, then you can start persuading people. But first, you have to get someone to like you before you can convince them of anything.
And in so doing, you haven't really revealed anything about yourself.
No, you really don't. But you do, but do they pick it up? I mean, we're always constantly communicating nonverbally. So if somebody knows these things, I would assume that we're communicating too, and they're picking up different things nonverbally.
So as a former FBI special agent, I imagine your job was really tough because you had to get people to confess to their crimes and find out if people were spies. And these were probably people that you didn't really like, but you had to get them to like you enough to reveal information. So what was the most useful technique that you used to help them change sides?
You know, I think it's a combination of things. Initially, you build that rapport. When you first meet them, you eyebrow flash, you tilt your head, you smile, and that lets them know that you're not a threat. And then you use empathic statements. Usually when I arrest somebody, the first thing I say is, I'll bet you when you woke up this morning, you didn't think you'd be in handcuffs by noon. And that's an empathic statement that describes exactly what they're feeling. And they go like, yeah, you bet I didn't. And then you can take that empathic statement a few more times, construct a few more empathic statements. And then you can, I think we ought to talk about how do you construct an empathic statement first.
Sure.
The construction of an empathic statement, a simple empathic statement, begins with so you. So I say, so you sound happy. So you didn't think. And what we're doing is keeping the focus on that other person. And if you keep the focus on the other person, it's on them, it's about them, and all you're doing is acknowledging their what they feel or what they're saying or what they're thinking. And because, you know, the last thing a person wants to hear is, I know what you're thinking, I know what you're feeling, because, you know, the reaction is, no, you don't. You're not me. You don't know what I'm thinking. You don't know what I'm feeling. But if you say, so you, then you keep the focus on that other person. And what that does, now this kind of interlaces into another principle, and that's the golden rule of friendship. And by the way, this rule works 100% of the time without fail. This is one of the few things I can tell you works 100% in behavioral situations. And that is, if you want someone to like you, you make them feel good about themselves. Because if every time you're with me, I make you feel good about you, you're going to want to come back to see me again to get that same good feeling. And in many instances, I won't even have to ask you to come by and see me. You'll think of an excuse to come by and get that same good feeling again. But what you're doing is you're taking all the emphasis off you, all the focus off you, and you're putting it on another person to make them feel good about themselves.
And it's normal human nature for people to want to feel good about themselves.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and the other thing is, we're so wrapped up in ourselves. When somebody finally acknowledges that we're the focus of attention, and they understand through empathic statements, they understand what you're thinking or feeling, you don't think that's odd. You think, well, it's about time somebody figured out I'm the center of the world. What I'm saying is, these things are just natural things. They're just, what we're trying to do is just thin slice that human interaction, the human behaviors. These things we do all the time, we just don't recognize that we do them. You know, like the friend signals. When I explain to people about the eyebrow flash, they come back the next day and they go like, my gosh, I eyebrow flashed like 100 people yesterday. I caught myself. And I saw all the eyebrow flashes, but I never saw them before you brought my attention to it. So a lot of these things are very subtle. And if we can intentionally do them, then we can influence the other person. For, you know, a prime example, have you ever returned something that was broken to a store? It's very difficult. You got to realize that other person, they sit there 8 hours a day, listen to people yelling at them about broken things and to fix it. And they usually have the urban scowl on too, because they're angry. So what I like to do is I walk up, tilt my head, smile, and I said, I bet you're really busy today. Yeah, you wouldn't believe all the complaints I get. Yeah, people are complaining all the time. It must, you know, be hard for you to listen to all the complaints. And that, those are nothing more than empathic statements. Now, you get that person to like you, and then you say, well, I've got this situation. And if they like you, they're going to give you better service. Because people who like other people bend over backwards. This is the irony of the whole thing. If I put someone else first and I'm truly friends with them, they're going to want to help me and do everything they can to help me because we're friends.
And then that's a win-win for everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a win-win. And when I see people go up to those complaint desks, turn this merchandise in, this product's no good and it's broken, it's this and it's that. I'm like, that's a recipe for disaster. Because the person behind the counter who has all the power to say yes or no for that, you know, return, why would you want to get them angry? What did they have to do with the manufacturing of the product?
What has surprised you the most in your whole career? What surprised you most about human nature and human behavior?
That it's so consistent. and it's cross-culture, and it's very consistent. What I teach is core human behaviors. Of course, we have to put, it's like a cake. Core human behaviors is the cake, and then we have to put the culturally specific frosting on the cake. But the core human behaviors, no matter if I'm in the United States, I'm in the Middle East, I'm in Asia, they're basically, those principles are the same, because we're all humans. We all have the same needs, although we do have cultural frosting on the cake. That's what amazed me, is how the same people are at that behavioral level. We all want the same things. We have the same needs. We have the same drives. We just express that in different ways through our culture.
You also say that people are curious by nature, and you advise people to use a curiosity hook in order to attract new friends. Tell us what a curiosity hook is and how to use it.
Well, people are curious by nature. We have to be, because if something new comes into our environment, we have to decide if it's a threat or not. If we decide that it's not a threat, then what do? We walk over there to figure out, can we take advantage of it? Can we use it? Can we eat it? Can we use it for something else? And because it's not a threat, we want to find out what that is. So what I generally would, you know, how you use a curiosity hook is, if you put something on your shirt, you wear a logo of a sports team, or a NASCAR logo, or any type of jewelry that's very unique, people will come up and talk to you and say, oh, I see, I like that thing you're wearing. That's interesting. You just wear a button, and people will come up and talk to you and talk about what's on that button. So you're getting people now to come to you through curiosity. And I tell this to the students in the dorms, the freshmen especially, when, you know, they're very lonely at first, and they want to meet friends that have the same interests they do, especially shy people. And I just tell them, leave your dorm room door open to let people know that you're available. The second thing you want to do is put a hobby that you have. I don't care what the hobby is. Put some, whatever paraphernalia is associated with the hobby, you put it on a desk where people walking by the hall can see it. And then what happens is, now the people are self-selecting. The people that aren't interested in that hobby or interest you have, they go by. The people that are will stop and poke their head in and say, oh, you're a Cubs fan. You're a Sox fan. You know, you like needlepoint. You do quilt working, whatever you have on there. So the shy person can actually make friends by having them approach, you know, have the strangers approach them, and then they become friends because they have that common ground. Common ground is one of the most powerful ways that you can make friends with somebody and establish rapport. So that person that was shy and has a hard time getting out, you don't have to do that. You get people to come to you. And interestingly enough, the people that have the same interests as you, and once you have the same interests as somebody, that's common ground. And then that's the beginning of a relationship.
I think a lot of us figure on some level that we're pretty good at reading people, pretty good at telling whether somebody likes us or doesn't like us, and that kind of thing. Does your experience tell you that we really are good at reading other people or not?
Yes, I think we are subconsciously. I think we're very good at reading people because that's what we've done for many, many years. I mean, centuries. We've looked at people and we've seen eyebrows that curl up. We've seen faces that snarl up. We're like, oh, I better not talk. I better not do this. This is unacceptable. That's unacceptable. So we got really good at reading the nonverbals. So I think we're really good at that. It's only when we get into this the nonverbal or the verbal area with the texting and social media that we don't use those verbal skills or the nonverbal skills, and we end up being at a disadvantage. So what I counsel people to do is, if you're going to meet somebody online, what you want to do is get a meeting with them in, you know, in a public safe area, you know, and meet them face to face, or Skype them, because once you start using your visual cues again, then you can better judge who that person is and whether they're somebody you want to be friends with.
One of the concepts that you talk about that I found to be so interesting was that people have gotten really used to lying their way through a day by saying that they're fine, even if they're not, if they're having the worst day ever, and that somebody else looks good, even if we think that they're wearing the ugliest sweater we've ever seen. So how did it become acceptable for us to lie this way? And how do we justify this to ourselves?
Well, you got to define lie now. So if I'm a dad, and believe me, I've gotten a lot of ugly ties throughout the years. So, and Father's Day, I get yet another ugly tie. What am I going to tell my kid? This is an ugly tie?
That's true. You have to make them feel good.
I don't want to say that. So I say, oh, this is a good looking tie, and this is great.
Thank yeah, and so I would have picked that myself.
Now, is that a lie? How about if I'm at a dinner party with you and your food is bad, rubber chicken, you know, sour wine, nothing's working right. I mean, it's just a horrible dinner. And I'm exiting your house. I'm leaving. And I'm going to tell you that was a good dinner. Right?
Sure. Sure. Right. Cause we want to be yeah. liked and we want our well, interactions to be what, pleasurable.
What I don't want to do is what I'm doing is, I guess, when I make that remark, I'm acknowledging your existence. I'm acknowledging your efforts. So is it really a lie?
You don't want to hurt somebody.
No, of course you don't want to hurt somebody. But we get so used to that, we can lie pretty well, can't we?
Yeah, yeah.
And we teach our kids to lie, too. You know, when Aunt Mary comes by with that ugly thing we got for Christmas or a birthday, what do we say? Tell Aunt Mary you like it. Tell Aunt Mary it's good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Don't hurt Aunt Mary's feeling. And then when we ask if a kid did something, we always tell them, look me in the eye when you say that. So a kid that wants to deceive his parents, the parent is teaching them, if I look in my parents' eyes, then they're going to believe me.
Yeah.
So we're learning a lot of these ways to lie very subtly. And it's not too hard to make that transition into bigger lies. You know, lines get a little blurred sometimes.
You know, Dr. Schaefer, our show is called Nobody Told Me, and we always ask our guests what it is that nobody told you when you were starting out in your career path. So for you, when you were starting out with the FBI or when you were starting out in behavior analysis, what is the thing that nobody told you that you had to learn on your own?
Let me think. Well, nobody told me how difficult it is to be in law enforcement. I was a police officer and then in the FBI. Nobody told me how difficult that is because you have to make snap decisions. You have to make, you know, face ethical dilemmas day in and day out. And it's not like on TV. And nobody wants to talk about those things. Everyone wants to say how great a job is and how wonderful things are. Nobody ever told me, this is going to be a difficult job. You're going to miss Christmas. You're going to miss new, you know, holidays, birthdays, anniversaries, kids' parties, kids' things at school. Nobody told me about those hardships in law enforcement. And you're going to be facing dangerous situations. You know, you could get yourself killed. Nobody talks about those things. So when I talk to my 101 students, I always take a day and say, I'm going to tell you today about the things nobody tells you about law enforcement. This isn't shown on TV. And people don't want to talk about bad things. They want to talk about good things. So I always spend that one day telling them about missed anniversaries and all the things that you have, the hardship. And then your wife and your family, how do they feel when you're not there for the birthdays and you're always gone doing things because you're called out for some emergency somewhere? So that's a difficult thing that nobody told me.
Dr. Schaefer, it has been so wonderful to talk to you. How can people find you on social media and how can they buy the Like Switch?
Well, it's on Amazon.com. Yeah, Amazon.com, and it's on Audible. It's on iPod. It's on iTunes. And I have a Facebook page called The Like Switch. And then, of course, in Barnes & Noble and other major stores have copies of the book that are available for purchase.
And you also have a website, don't you? Is it, I think it's drjackschaefer.com?
Yeah, drjackschaefer.com.
Okay, great.
And that's a website. So it's available in many ways you can get the book. And it's in, by the way, it's in 18 languages. So.
Oh, my gosh. Oh,
you've touched a nerve there.
Yeah. So anybody all over the world will be able to read it.
Well, it's fantastic, you know, and a great resource for people, regardless of what industry they're in. Yeah. If they're just trying to make friends or improve relationships at work.
Yeah, business folks, salespeople like it a lot, because what that does is they're always cold calling people. And this gives them the tools they need to have the confidence to meet a stranger, make them become friends, and then try to sell goods or services to them.
Well, Dr. Schaefer, thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us. It's been fascinating, and we can go on for hours and hours, but we'll just advise our listeners to check out the book, The Light Switch, or check out the website, drjackschaefer.com. Dr. Schaefer, thank you so much.
All right, you're welcome.
Take care. I'm Jan Black.
Right, bye-bye.
And I'm Laura Owens.
And this is Nobody Told Me.
I like me better when I'm with you.
Summer camp is a magic place where kids discover who they are because they have the freedom to explore on their own. Y Camp at Horse Thief Reservoir is a sleepaway camp in the heart of Idaho's wilderness. Each summer, campers make friends, build new skills, and learn to love the outdoors through activities like canoeing, archery, zip lining, rock climbing, campfires, and more. Registration for Y Camp at Horse Thief Reservoir is open. Financial assistance is available. Learn more at ycampidaho.org.